Thank you for listening to the audio podcast of the King's Crossing Church of Christ. To learn more or subscribe, please visit our website at kingscrossingcoc.com. Well, earlier, Justin promised you a really good lesson, and then Ron said it's going to be a really good lesson. And on the one hand, I appreciate the encouragement. On the other hand, I'm feeling a little pressure now. Thank you, Ridge. Yeah, no pressure. So it's interesting to me, depending on where you live, when you think of going to a beautiful and restful spot, you might think about different things. Having grown up myself in Nashville, Tennessee, if you were to say at the time, like, Mark, where would you want to go if you wanted to find a beautiful and restful place? I would have probably told you I'd want to come to a place like this. I'd want to go where there's a beach and an ocean so I could see the sand and the ocean water. And I've discovered when I moved down to Corpus Christi, if I were to ask a lot of you where you would think of going, if you wanted to go to someplace beautiful and restful, you would probably mention mountains or maybe the hill country or something like that. It's amazing how sometimes that contrast is something that is nourishing to us. We enjoy seeing the variety and the beauty of creation. But I want you to imagine that if I could tell you whatever it is you picture when you think of a beautiful and restful place, I just want you to imagine that you could go there. And I'm telling you, ideal location picked out for you. It's a place that you like, that you would enjoy. And I can tell you that right now the schedule is wide open for you to have it for as long as you'd like to be there. There is one question that you would probably pop up with, which is, thank you. Yeah. How much is this going to cost me? Right? Nothing like that is ever free for us, is it? What is it going to cost me to get there? So as we are in kind of a Christmas season, it is a time that people are thinking about the birth of Jesus and what it means and what it meant for Jesus to come into the world. I wanted to spend a few weeks talking about how God did come near in the person of Jesus. And the way that we're doing this is that we're looking at some of the oldest predictions that dealt with the Messiah, the coming one. We're looking at some of the oldest texts that talk about that, and then we're looking at what Jesus did to fulfill that and what it means for us. And so, for example, last week we talked about that passage in Genesis 2, the first messianic text, we think, where God is dealing with the serpent and says, you may bruise his heel, but he's going to crush your head. Ultimately, the descendant of Adam was going to come along and undo the work of the devil in the world. That was a passage we looked at last week. This week, we're going to be looking here at Genesis chapter 12, and this does deal with Abraham. And even though God actually makes this promise and reiterates it several times in the life of Abraham, this is one of the first encounters where God tells Abraham what it is he intends to do for him as a person of so much faith. So, and what he does here in Genesis chapter 12 is that he actually paints a portrait of a nice place to go. So I had you think about a restful, beautiful place. What he describes in these verses, I think any of us would view as a restful, good place you'd want to be in life. And I'm sure Abraham shared that. So not just a place to go, but more of a state of being, what it would be like to be Abraham. He said, I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. You know, in fact, in Justin's communion devotional, as he read to us Mary's song, Mary references this very idea as he read through there, the idea of to be a blessing for Abraham and his offspring forever. She's invoking this passage in Genesis 12. Mary is, in her own faith, there at the prospect of Jesus being born. But when you look at this vision has several components that make it so wonderful, beautiful, restful, whatever adjectives you'd like to use to describe it. This is a vision of increased blessings, in his case, in terms of family, but also materially, that it's a vision where blessings increase. It's a vision for a good reputation, that all throughout the world, even if you're never going to get 100% of the people to like anybody, but many in the world would speak of Abraham. He was going to have a good reputation. He was going to have personal significance, that people's relationship to God, to their own blessings, to some degree would be relative to the way they treated this person. He had such significance that if you show kindness to Abraham, God would show kindness to you. If you showed harshness or cruelty toward him, God would hold you accountable. We even see that play out in his life. But he was blessed to be a person of great significance. And then we see that ultimately he was going to have an ability to affect good things, that because of him, all peoples would be blessed, not just a few, not just one pocket, not just one time in history, but even here, sitting here today, all of us are in some way blessed through Abraham and through his family. We still see God fulfilling that promise. And so you might ask of this passage what we asked of the vacation spot: what is it going to cost? What is it going to take to be able to get to that place? Because I think that's a destination we'd all enjoy in our life. I'd like those things. I'd like increased blessings and a good reputation. I'd like to be personally significant. I'd like to bring about good things that have lasting value. That's something that any of us would want. So what does it take for us to get there? Knowing, in fact, that some of these things, it really would take God himself to establish. I have a limited ability to know what happens beyond my life, what becomes of the things that I've done. Really, some of these things that are promised, only God himself could accomplish. We could do it temporarily, but not in such a lasting way. And so, just before this vision, in verses 2 and 3, we have verse 1, which I would say is sort of Abraham's great commission. You know, God has sent us. At this time, he sends Abraham. God says to him, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land that I will show you. Go. That's the first word he begins with. Now, isn't it often the case in our life that we might even have a good thing in our possession, but in order to have a better thing, sometimes we have to let go of what's most familiar to us, don't we? To know God more deeply, sometimes it means you may have to let go of your current understanding of God in order to build on it in a truer, deeper sense. Sometimes we have to let go of something in order to accept and grasp something even better. Now, at Abraham's point in life, this was a decidedly inconvenient thing to do. At the time that God comes to him and tells him, you're going to leave your setting, your family, your land, and you're going to go to this place I'm going to show you, you know, he's already 75 years old. 75 is not generally the age that people want to think about having to start anything over again. In fact, the way we kind of structure our society, it's expected that basically you work yourself until you're absolutely exhausted, then hopefully somewhere around that time frame you can retire and ideally just do nothing until you die, right? Like that's one narrative about the American dream, right? You work to death and hopefully save up enough money where at some point you can just quit everything. But the vision for what Abraham was going to be, the vision for what it means to be a person of God, is not that in this life we're trying to reach a stopping point. As a Christian, you never want to get to the point where you say, well, I did some good stuff for God in my 30s and 40s, but now I'm going to sit back and it's time for someone else to do stuff. Certainly, you'd want to invite them along with you, but we don't ever quit or retire when it comes to serving the Lord. So even at 75 years old, when God came to Abraham and said, I'm going to bless you richly, but I want you to do something that's going to get you way outside of what's comfortable for you, Abraham was still willing to do that. There's a book that came out. My grandfather gave me a copy of this book. I don't know when it was published. It's by a guy named Ivan Stewart, and I really just love the title of the book. It says, Go Ye means go me. It's pretty catchy. Go ye means go me. What God said to Abraham was go. That was the first word in his statement, go. What Jesus said to us is go. I wonder if you've seen this comic strip before. At the top, someone's asking the question, who is it that wants change? And everybody raises their hands. Everybody wants some kind of change, but who wants to change? Not so many hands go up at that prospect. And so thinking about that comic strip, the temptation would be in our minds to start singling out groups of people we'd love to accuse of that kind of behavior, right? I have to tell you, though, in my experience, I think all people of all ages struggle with change and going into things that are unfamiliar. That's really not a problem just for people as they get older. My experience in youth ministry was that teenagers resisted change just as much as anyone else did. When it comes to having to go against something that their peers might would want them to do. But even for me, it was things like the youth group calendar. We had a calendar, and I had a pretty good routine, and every year I would talk to the teens and say, well, you know, we've always done this youth rally or this event or that event, but I totally don't mind if y'all want to change it up and we can do a different youth rally or a different place, or we could just cancel this thing and replace it with this other thing. And inevitably, the whole group would be in an uproar and say, no, we can't change any of that stuff. We always do that stuff. You know, and I'm talking about 13, 14, 15-year-olds. Change is hard for everyone, isn't it? But what we're talking about, I think, in this passage, it's not just changing things arbitrarily, right? It doesn't necessarily make anything better just to stop doing it the way you have done it and do it some different way. There needs to be purpose behind the things that we're going to change. In Abraham's life, he made significant changes, but he made these changes for a purpose. There was a reason for them. So it's important that we always dwell on the reasons for why we do the things that we do. So I mentioned in my announcements earlier that we are in the process of taking a congregational survey, and I have to tell you, so far in the responses that are coming in, I've been very pleased with your all's connection to reality. Some of the things that you all are saying are exactly the kinds of things I would hope you would be saying. People are giving me feedback such as, you know, it's not sufficient for us just to build a building and hope that everything changes and gets better, but we need to be stepping up and doing more. We need to be making the most of our opportunities. We need to be really intentional about the things we're going to do. You're giving great suggestions about people groups we should be thinking about to whom we might could do a better job of ministering. But there seems to be a pretty healthy understanding among us that, you know, things won't be different or better unless we're willing to do a little more, or perhaps occasionally do things a little differently. Change means that we may well have to go the way that Abraham went. It might mean signing your name on that line that says, I'll do it. It might mean stepping up and involving your family, even when it'd be more convenient just to go do something else that you'd rather do. It means putting God first in your commitments. Reflecting on Abraham and his prospect, what did it mean for him to get ready to go? In order to go, it means several things, doesn't it? It means leaving your territory. For us, we might could talk about our comfort zone. If I'm going to do something better for God, it almost by definition means I'm going to have to do something that maybe I'm not sure I'm going to succeed at, or I might not think I'm even good at. But sometimes it means leaving your territory. It means trying something that I haven't tried before and stepping out, really believing I could possibly fail at the thing that I'm doing. Sometimes it means that I can't just simply stay with the people that I know best. Abraham had to leave behind all his family and relatives, all the people that he'd ever known, everyone who would have given him a good reputation back in the day. He left all those behind to go to a new place. If we're serious about bringing people into the kingdom of God, you can't save any lost people if you don't know any. You're not ultimately going to save people who don't view you as someone who cares about them. We have to sometimes go a distance, go to people that we wouldn't always talk to. We have to be willing to have our worldview challenged. Can you imagine being Abraham, being the only person likely who worshiped the true God, going into Canaanite territory where they had just abominable worship practices, terrible things that they would do, and he's the only one doing things his way, but just the same, he had to go and have his worldview challenged. Even if it's a bad worldview, people like to do what's most familiar to them. In order to challenge something, we have to be present, but we also have to be willing to be challenged. If we're serious about shining our light, to use Jesus's terms, there is no neutral option for us in how it is that we're going to build our life. If you wish to be a truly godly person, some of the time you're not going to fit in. And if your biggest goal is always to fit in, then ultimately that will often lead to you not truly being a godly person. You really do have to choose many times between those paths. So Abraham did accept that opportunity to get to that beautiful destination of blessing and all the things God promised. He did make the move. He moved away from all that was familiar to him to an unfamiliar place with unfamiliar people to try and be God's person there. So what did he do? This is interesting. He took his wife, he took his nephew, he took his possessions, and he moved over there to the Canaanite territory, and he put up his tents where he was going to dwell. But what else he did to me is really interesting. He says in verse 6 of Genesis 12, Abram traveled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moreh in Shechem. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he went on toward the hills east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. So you know, for us to make a positive impact in the world, it involves more than just going, doesn't it? Because once we get there, we have to be a particular kind of presence. In your life, you want to be a particular kind of Christian presence that people can see. It's good to go, but even beyond going, we have to be a kind of person wherever we are that is conspicuous. Abram built an altar there in Canaanite territory. He built an altar where he was going to worship God. This is a picture that I took in the city of Dan. So this is an ancient site, much the way that in the United States we might talk about things from coast to coast, or you might talk about from like New York to L.A. When they wanted to refer to kind of the whole of all of Israel, they would talk about all the area from Dan to Beersheba. That was their way of saying from the northern tip to the southern tip. So Dan is located in the very northernmost part and is actually one of the first places they had significant trouble with idolatrous worship. And so what they've done is they've taken this old site where they'd uncovered where an altar had been, and they've put up a metal frame so you can see something like what the altar would have looked like. And do you know that they can actually tell just by what you see here that this was not an altar built properly to God's standards? I wonder if you know why. When God told his people to build altars, like to Abraham, they were always to use rough stones. They weren't to have things that were so polished and finished out that perhaps people might be tempted to focus more on the means of worship than on the one they were worshiping. But because this was built against the standards that God would have required, it's entirely possible that when you read in Scripture about the idolatrous practices in Dan, this might be the actual spot that he's talking about when you see that show up in Scripture. But God gave some specific instructions. And so I'd like you to imagine, if you're trying to be like Abraham, if you're trying to be present in the world, you're trying to be present with people who don't know Christ, how can you think of your life as an altar among the Gentiles, so to speak? One thing we have to do is that we do have to build to God's standards. I've always loved that detail that God preferred to have his altars built of rough and unfinished stones. You know, God doesn't want you to only try and present a version of yourself that's so polished and perfect that no one would ever think that you're flawed or relatable. He wants you to use the actual pieces that you have of your life and worship him with those. So even with your occasional bad habits and your missteps and your family, as much as you love them, not always perfect, he wants you to use those building blocks that he's given you and do the best you can to worship him in this very setting where you are, not just an overly polished version of yourself, but coming to him as you are with authenticity. He wants you to be built together in a conspicuous way. So often altars were built at some of the higher places, were they not? They were built in high places. Perhaps they're assuming this would get them a little closer to God, a little closer to heaven, but they're always something that was conspicuous. I would imagine as soon as you saw that altar, you had some assumptions about what it was that it might be. Whatever it is that you're going to care about deeply in your life, you want to do this in such a way that you're really open about it, that you're conspicuous in what your priorities are. An altar is also something that's created specifically to connect with God. That's its whole purpose. There wasn't a dual-purpose altar where you'd worship God on it one day and have to use it for something else the next day. Altars only existed so that God could be glorified. This is what it should be for us to glorify God in our lives. that in our lives, we are always a place where something is being given up for God's sake, that we make valuable sacrifices, that even though we have many things we value, we show that we believe God to be of greater value. And truly, in the world, aren't there so many people offering up their lives and their talents and their energies to lesser gods? Whether it's just the god of material things they want to own, they'll sacrifice their family, they'll sacrifice their beliefs and everything else just to make a few more dollars and get the extra stuff that they'll be tired of 5 years from now. We have that altar. There's the altar of how people just want to be seen. They'd sacrifice anything to get the title, to get the reputation. They'll let everything else in their life fall apart to get the one thing. There are so many people sacrificing on altars that won't ultimately bring them fulfillment. But we want to live our lives as altars to God, who gives us good things and blessings. One way you can sort this out would be to think about your life and the important parts of your life and ask, who is it that sits on top of this? So what about your schedule? What is the one thing on your schedule that you're not willing to compromise for anything else? Is God reflected in that priority, or is there something else that gets to push God out of the schedule when you have a different agenda? We could talk about your schedule. We could talk about your budgeting. We could talk about a lot of different things. But, you know, if you want to live a life that glorifies God, you always start by putting God on top of that pile. And then you see if anything else deserves to be big enough to knock him off of that top spot. God needs to come first. There's a quote that I came across this week that I found this one really mind-blowing. You may have heard before of Richard Wurmbrand. He was a Romanian Christian minister, and he was of Jewish descent. And so in the time period and locations where he was, this led to a pretty rough life for him. He spent 14 years of his life imprisoned and tortured by communists. And thinking again, what does it look like to set your life up as an altar in a foreign land, even in a hostile foreign land? I was really floored by this quote. He says, "It was strictly forbidden to preach to other prisoners. It was understood that whoever was caught doing this received a severe beating. A number of us decided to pay the price for the privilege of preaching. And so we accepted the communists' terms. It was a deal. We preached, and they beat us. We were happy preaching. They were happy beating us. So everyone was happy." You know, boy, what an unexpected twist to that comment. But what an incredible sense of peace and purpose this man demonstrates. To be in the worst of circumstances and say, well, in the end, because I'm doing the thing that matters most to me, because I'm not compromising my truest priority, everyone is happy. You know, all of us have to make that decision in our life that I am going to be for something. There is something that's going to define me more than the other things. There are certain things that are going to get priority in my life above all else. We have to make decisions about what it is we're going to make be those things. Each of us has to say, what is it my life is going to be for? What is the thing that will define me more than anything else? And so thinking about God's promise to Abraham of this beautiful destination, ultimately this is fulfilled in the person of Jesus Christ. When Jesus came in the flesh, Genesis 12 is one of the passages that starts to become true. That when we live in such a way that people could say, I know that that person is truly for Christ in all that they do, these things start to become true in your life. We do live in a place of increased blessings, that even as we mentioned Richard Wurmbrand, even in the worst of circumstances, as James talks about, we can even rejoice in the hard circumstances because we have a sense of hope that transcends all of those things in the world. We have increased blessings no matter our circumstances. We get to have a good reputation, not just in the world, but to know that your name is known and spoken in the presence of God. I love the portrait of a person at the end of their life standing before God and God saying, well done. Aren't those beautiful words? Well done, good and faithful servant. And who would you want to value your reputation more than God himself? Great personal significance, that even if no one here ever knows what you do or all the things you're at work at behind the scenes, God sees and acknowledges those things, and your reputation goes with you. Your significance goes with you. And ultimately, this ability to bring about good things, that our efforts, as imperfect as they are, sometimes we make mistakes, sometimes our efforts don't go as well as we hope that they would, but when we do things for Christ, nothing is ever truly wasted. Nothing is ever truly wasted because God is the one who establishes the work of our hands. Of all the different things you could choose to worship in your life, the things that you could choose to put on top of your life as your greatest priority, the one thing that sets God apart from all these things is that when you worship God, when you sacrifice for God, He's the one being, the one entity that truly gives you back more than you could ever offer to Him in the first place. You know, if you choose to give to God your work, your vocation, your occupation, if you always work as if you're working for the Lord Himself and you work with all your might and you do everything you can to be a person of integrity, God is the one who helps your reputation to increase. And often we see greater opportunities because of our Christian character. When you sacrifice your work to God, God gives you many blessings in return. When you choose to give your family to God, to teach all of them to follow Jesus more than they do anything else, in fact, God strengthens your family. He gives peace to your family and strengthens the relationships that you have with each other. If you choose to give your full identity to God, that you don't just worry about your ego or your title, but that you want to give God everything about you, God is the one who establishes your reputation. We all have to strive to let our lives be like that altar where God is always lifted up and worshiped in all that we do, in all parts of our life.